Hi, Martin.
Right.
How's it going?
Yeah, and this week we have our first, actually, last Thursday we started our first test migration to Folio. And it's still going
That is exciting stuff. And are y'all with, is it OCLC that y'all use? What do y'all use currently?
No, it's a system by OCLC. Well, actually, it wasn't developed by OCLC, but they bought the company, and now it's OCLC. It used to be a local company here, and so it's the system is mainly used in our region. So I think it's nothing that you know about.
I think I've only, yeah, I've only heard about it from you, I think.
Yeah, it's called CSIS. Yeah.
Well, good luck. Any
Yeah, thank you.
hiccups so far, or is it just trucking along?
Yeah, well, actually, it's our we as library, we are not doing the actual migration. It's done by the library network headquarters. And at the moment they are importing all the instances and holdings and items. So that's gonna take 1 week and a bit. We have about 4 to 5 million instances and items each. So
Wow.
yeah, it takes a bit. And yeah,
That's
and after
intense.
that we're going to migrate the orders and invoices and all that stuff, and users, I mean patrons, and yeah, and loans, and
Organizations.
yeah, exactly. So that's coming, I think that's coming next week.
I think we started with users like the very first time around, or I think we started with the smallest and kind of worked our way up.
Yeah, but we're doing the other way around. So we're starting with the biggest bunch of data.
But we also we did test migrations for a whole year out from our final migration. We just did it over and over and over and over again for like once a month for a year.
Yeah. So I did some, I personally did some test migrations before with also with the instance data and part of the item and holdings data and organizations, but that's also there's a lot of a lot of data sets. I have no clue if everything is going to be okay. So that's a bit there's a bit of how to call it suspense right now.
Yeah, I bet. How about you two? Thomas, Charlotte, how are y'all doing? Nope, you're muted.
Doing good. I'm just coming out of a meeting with NLS, and we are doing it a little different because we have worked for almost a year on the test environment and got all data, trimmed and tested and back and forth and back and forth with Charles Ledvina. And now we have planned 4 dry runs. So, but
Four drivers.
we're doing the first one now here in February. And then
Okay.
we, that's also a process. And right now we have planned for if the first one is going, totally bananas or something, then we will do more, of course.
Yeah. So, and y'all are going to Eureka?
Yes.
Wow. That's exciting.
We're going to have a sunflower with okapi first.
You know,
I mean,
it's
we also,
working
I
for
think
us.
we also spent money for that, so
Yeah.
Why don't we? So we should use that.
Yeah, and so y'all are going to NLS is going to Eureka with Kong then. Do you know?
NLS has decided to postpone the go live to after WolfCon, so that's going to be in September. So
Okay.
it's going to be on Trillium.
Okay.
Hopefully, Trillium, one of the critical service patch 1.2, so we have a little cleanup. But yeah.
So hopefully the API 6 stuff will be switched over by then. Yeah, okay.
So, but the thinking for NLS is, yeah, I'm sure it will be good. But
Yeah.
is that have a clean Eureka and do not carry over any mismatch from Okapi. So that has been their thinking from the very beginning.
Well, we all got to do it at some point. So everybody
Yes.
who's diving in, I'm like, all right, let's go, let's do it.
But I've heard Stanford is doing well as well and is planning to shift over sometime soon.
Okay.
Yeah, I was just talking to Darcy. I think, what she say? March, I think is when I'm moving over. They had the Eureka system up and running on their test environment. I'm sorry, their test bed environment. They're now trying to spin it up on their test environment for pre-production. And if they can do that without any hiccups, then they're going to go ahead and move to production. Yeah. They're having fun. And we are migrating a library into our Folio instance, and it's driving me nuts.
Oh, yeah, I've done that several times, and I'm done with that. If we integrate any more libraries into our system, I'm gonna like advocate to just bring them in as separate tenants. I think it's a
Ah,
nightmare.
you're having separate libraries actually as in the same tenant?
Yeah, we operate our medical science library right alongside our main library, and then we also brought in a branch campus down in Galveston, the coastal city in Texas. That's part of our Texas A&M system. We integrated them into our catalog, and it works, but it was not fun.
But why aren't you jumping into the consortia solution?
Well, I mean, at the time that we did this, it was scary. It's gotten more mature, and I think we might consider that. Though I do have to say that the arrangement between, I mean, this is super weird, but like our OPACs are not the same between these different libraries, so we're not actually operating as a full consortia. So, I don't know. I don't make the decisions. I just do the things that they tell me to do. But
Same.
I was
That's
just
kind of what
like,
happens.
wow, that you're using the word OPAC. Didn't know that you're using it as well in the US, English speaking countries. I would have guessed that it's a German word made English.
We use it too in Scandinavia.
Okay.
I forget what the abbreviation is for it, but yeah, we use OPAC Discovery Layer.
I think it's Open Public Access Catalog or something like that, or
Sounds right.
I just made that up, but I sorry again, it sounds right.
It fits because
Let me
we're
Google.
we are what was it? We are migrating Weill Medical School into
Okay.
ours.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the same thing as like the one that you just described, is that they're going to be using EDS and Locate for their discovery layer. We use Blacklight. They have a separate e-holding system than we do, but we're going to be in a shared instance. And right now I'm looking at, they're on Alma right now. Right now I'm looking at their user groups, and they have, let's see, there's one header. They have 92 user groups in Alma that we need to figure out how
Nice.
to map into Folio. And because they load everyone in there, it like they have probably like 50 or 60 of them are affiliates with the university that probably never use their cards, that they are loading in constantly into Alma. And we're like, I'm thinking to myself, no, you're not going to do this to Folio. You're not adding all these people to Folio. I don't care. You can add them one by one piecemeal.
Yeah. You have to have those kind of conversations, you know, when you're like map like this tiny branch library that we brought in. I mean, it's, you know, it's a very small library, and they had, you know, like 75 locations or something like that. And it was literally like you would like stand in the middle of their like room, and they'd be like, "Well, that shelf is a location, and that shelf is a location." I was like, "All right, well,
Well,
let's
you're
figure
not
out how to
doing it like
reduce
that. Are you not
this." Sorry.
doing it like that?
Yeah.
Our we are actually how do I say making our locations more fine granular than we used before. So I don't know. We are gonna have to in Folio like 1,200 locations.
That's all. Well, I would love to hear how that works out. If it holds up
I
to
mean,
that, then maybe
okay.
we'll all follow suit.
I'm sure we have solved the curse of 10 on locations, but I have not heard about, 4-digit numbers. But yeah, you
Yeah,
will.
I know. I mean,
Oh.
there's one other library in our library network that has already migrated, and they also have more than
Okay.
1,000 locations, and they
Okay.
said that they have difficulties in displaying. Oh, in
Yes.
yeah, using the locations because Folio just more than 1,000 locations Folio doesn't display or doesn't.
Then you
That is correct.
probably there is a chat that happened in the metadata management, and you probably would it would be a smart move to include the code in your location name, so you can filter on the codes because
Yeah, that's what we are doing actually.
you
So
are doing
I
okay.
mean, our current system, they used numbers only
Okay.
as code, and so people are used to referring to locations as the location 03 or 18 or whatever. So and yeah, that's why we are still using these and everywhere because people just say, "Oh, it's in location 03." And
That is an issue. In fact, actually popped up. There's a hard API limit of 1,000 for locations.
Yeah,
No.
well, you can have more than 1,000
Mm-hmm.
locations, but Folio will
Yes.
only retrieve the first 1,000 locations
Exactly.
if you want to
Exactly.
have them displayed. I mean, that's
Yes.
if you're just searching by name or code or so, whatsoever, then it's no problem. That's why it's not gonna be a like really a problem, I guess. But yeah.
Yeah, I suppose if you gave it a search query
There's
that
no
had a
search.
result set over 1,000, then you would have an issue. But if you're starting with a little over 1,000, most of your search queries are going to reduce that number to
Yeah.
under 1,000.
But when you are adding all these locations, will the display then stop? So you will add in blind the remaining ones?
You know, I
Or
mean the locations are I mean they are spread over the libraries and campuses and so
okay.
underneath one library you never or we at least we never have more than let's say maximum 100 and not even that much I think. So
Okay.
it's not gonna happen that the in the settings pages or wherever the locations won't be displayed. That's at least yeah.
I think we have like 250 locations or something like that. I mean,
But
it works.
we have this problem everywhere. We also have like I don't know how many there are now, but we used to have like 3,000 organizations, and I ho heard from the guy from the Australian National Library that they also have a lot of locations, and there was also a border of or a limit of 1,000 locations within Folio, so they already had the problem, and so on. So that's yeah.
It's funny you're talking about this because guess who's the location PO? That's why I dropped those in there.
It's
Yeah, this came up as a bug. It's a hard limit on the API call that only retrieves the first 1,000 locations. The two images I dropped into chat is a proposed UI change that I would like to do with locations, which changes it around that it's more of a search interface that you can search for anywhere within the hierarchy. And then it just brings up all the hits for that. And it also adds pagination and then the details page. So that when you open up a location, you can see where it sits within the main campus, the institution, and then what service points are linked to it, what readings rooms are linked to it, that sort of thing. So we'll see if it actually gets done, but this was my solution to that
Yeah, but
issue.
the first things that strikes me is that you no longer have the tenant, what's it called? I mean, tenant settings. It's location settings. Yeah. Yeah,
It would pull
that's
down a
great.
tenant and
I never find the locations because I always think, well, where should they be or why are they put into tenant?
It's pulled out of tenants and it's separate from location. And the other idea behind this too was with ECS and with the ECS environments, all the location data is actually pushed from the individual tenants into the central index. So this could actually tap into the central index, so you could actually search through the locations through an entire ECS system and see what data tenants are using what locations as well. So it's the idea. We'll see if it happens.
Well, very, very cool. Do y'all mind if we pivot
go
to
for it.
discussions? So I thought that what we have been doing. And I do think we're gonna have enough time to get this wrapped up. What we have been doing is comparing the original DIP proposal to the DIP proposal that was contained within the CDDF, identifying the things that we felt like would be a good fit for a minimally viable DIP proposal. And with the intent of kind of taking those notes and those observations and composing a third version of the DIP proposal, which would be the minimally viable one. So I have started some work on combining those two into like a rough draft of a MVDIP, minimally viable DIP that I can bring to this group. I do think that there's been a topic or just kind of a point that I feel like I would benefit from some discussion on just because I don't understand it super well. And Charlotte mentioned during our planning meeting for the PC, she just mentioned some perspectives on scoping the MVP to the community development team specifically, which touches right on some of the things that have been kind of like that I've been trying to understand about what we're building. So I thought that we could kind of talk about the scope of the minimally viable DIP a little bit, if you guys are okay with that. I've written some questions out that might help guide a discussion. Is that
Sounds
okay if we
really
just kind of do more, some more conceptualization real quick?
sounds good, and I have also been thinking because I hope we can think smart, so we build in the DIP process in what the already very overwhelmed POs are asked to do, and we have this UX prod. Approach where we also have a template, and then I was thinking maybe we could write the DIPs as first very the questions for the DIP into a UX prod, and then the POs can add more details when it mature, because otherwise I am so nervous that we are doing overly complicated administration, because then things just will die. But if we can build it into a process we already do, and some of the things being asked for in the very initial DIP, we are already filling in a UX prod feature.
That's such a good idea. I love that idea. Yeah, just like it's almost like, I could imagine. All right. Charlotte, you've given me so much to think about.
Sorry.
It's all right. I'm going to say two things. One is like I could almost imagine like an automated tool that went through and identified new UX prods and like kind of pulled out data from them in order to kind of initialize a dip, that would be interesting. But that leads me to my next question, which is, do we feel like there is a one-to-one relationship between a UX prod and a dip?
I would say so, because we do also have UX prods, which is kind of being dropped again.
So
It
people are
is.
not making them as much.
No, I, what I mean is that the idea about doing some development has popped up, has been discussed, has been started, but
Yeah.
then maybe it is the idea died
Oh,
because
I
it
see.
was not a it didn't go all the way. So,
Okay.
and I can see the dip is the same. Also being suggested, proposed, there's happening some refinement around it, and then it can either be, pushed for to move on, or it can be told, nah, this is not the direction. We don't have support for it, da da da.
It's really, really interesting. So, okay. I'm
We could,
gonna.
in the name of the UX prod, where it's still in the dip state, call it dip and then a name for this UX prod. And then when it's out of being, when it's moved on and is no longer in this process where it needs to have some decision, we can remove it out of the title line. Or it
Yeah.
can be some labeling. It can also be dip draft and then later be dip decided or whatever the PC wanna
Yeah.
call it.
So, basically the MVP dip would be a structure a way of structuring the UX prod pages.
Yeah. And we
Items.
already have some structure. So I think you will probably notice that the UX prod, how we write them, is having more and more details. So we are trying to use a template. So we
Yeah.
could always just add, into this template also the headings for required for the dip.
Yeah. So I love this idea, and I think that we need to make sure that we hang on to this. Part of there's two things I think that we need to decide on. Charlotte, you mentioned that you felt that it was prudent for us to scope participation with the dip to the community development team because the current development teams would not appreciate having the burden of an additional bureaucratic process kind of plop down on their head, which I think makes really good
Or
sense.
as a start out, because then we can see it works well, and then we can talk with the other POs. Do you could we enhance it to also all the EBSCO EPAM teams, etc., etc.?
Yeah. So when you said that, what it initially made me think was that, of course you're right. I would not want to show my face at WolfCon next year if I was responsible for, requiring all the development teams to engage in like this, onerous process that no one appreciate it. But on the flip side, it made me think, well, we don't have a community development team, so that places a requirement that needs to be put in place before the that we could test the dip. We would need to actually get the team, fund it and organize, and that puts actually testing the dip probably a long way out by the time we actually get that sorted out. And I had, I guess, just always envisioned the dip as being an opt-in process, not a compulsory process, but a process that people would participate with willingly. And the reason why I thought that people would do that, because like, yeah, who would want to fill out extra paperwork, is that the dip was always intended as a mechanism for resourcing development efforts, for allowing for there to be an expression of intent to develop something so that people with resources could provide resources towards that development effort, either in kind or direct, funding resources. And I do feel like we've kind of made this decision that a minimal version of the dip doesn't include the resourcing piece. But with taking that away, you take away the one thing that I felt like was the incentive for participating with it. It just kind of becomes bureaucracy. I guess what I'm saying is I am not sure what the point is to the dip without the resourcing piece.
So I agree. Yeah, Martin, sorry.
I think one, but it may be a small incentive, but maybe it's one. I thought the idea of the dip, even of this minimal viable dip, would be to have some kind of structure within the development efforts. And I mean, and the benefit would be everything that you can do with structured or semi-structured data, that is having doing some analysis, I mean having metrics as we had within the in this effort from the CC. I think you also said that some items in this spreadsheet were it could be answered by the CDDF or by a dip. Even by a minimal viable dip. So, yeah, just maybe not being too forceful, but maybe pushing people into that direction by maybe having updated UX pro templates that record or that propose to record all the information that we foresee in the dip could be a way to making it opt-in, but also pushing people into that direction to record maybe one information or the other. And then you could maybe I'm not sure how easy that is, but you could do some kind of automatic analysis of all the UX prods and say, well, we have this many UX prods, and I don't know, this percentage has this and this dip information, and then we can see if people find it useful to record information as well, or analyze the information that they re recorded.
I know that the administrative piece, the analytical piece, is I mean, I guess I don't know. My impression is that that is Caitlin's attraction to the dip is the our ability to well, two things. One is our ability to kind of analyze what the community is doing, and then two, just the idea that we get kind of the opportunity to have input into plan development as early as possible, which is incidentally why, well, one of the reasons why, Charlotte, this idea of really trying to go after UX prod as, kind of the origin point for the dip makes good sense, because it doesn't get much earlier than UX prod, So if we're able to see a dip spin up at the same time as that, yeah.
And the UX prods have a very established workflow. We are using it for planning purposes in the flower releases. We are tracking that all work has been completed, also aligned with the UX prod. So they are, kind of carrying all the way until, and it's such a good feeling. You probably know that, Thomas, too, when you can say done on a UX prod. It happens maybe 10 times a year or something.
Yeah.
But it's then you have a little celebration and
10
can.
times a year. I'm lucky if it happens once a year.
You need to write smaller UX prods.
They're all UX prods are massive. Like, I just want to add a button here, ends up being like six sprints worth of work because that button interfaces with so many different modules. I mean, if you make I think part of our idea originally was though too is making the dip process as part of Jira, that it would actually be like a new ticket system. If you do that, it would be easy enough to go into a UX prod, duplicate it, change the type over to dip, and then just change what you need to change for the dip process. That could be one possibility. We're also not using Jira automation, so it's also very well possible that we could use Jira automation where you're in a UX prod and you click on something that says create dip and it actually creates a new Jira, extracts some of the information out and sticks it in there. I think one of the benefits that we could use, or one of the things that we could say is a benefit for this is, and this kind of ties into the not the documentation, but the release notes group, is the dips could be used to as a place to kind of summarize a human readable format of what the UX prod is doing or what new features is adding, which could then tie directly to the kind of like the public release notes that we want to generate. So that could be a part of it, like in a very brief summary of what functionality is this adding to Folio. I think the other part of it would be to allow us to track like where in the process it is, especially for UX prod, or especially for a feature that's an epic that has like four or five UX prods that are different phases. And a dip would tie them all together so we don't lose track of, okay, phase one was done, phase two was done, but phase three and four wasn't done. Charlotte.
So I agree that clone, then you can also create quickly can create a dip ticket. I just want to then mention that the PC for, is it 5 years ago or something, did larger work on doing all these road tickets, and that was for also for the PC's planning, and it died. Because it was simply kind of living in its own. Either us POs, we did a huge work linking to all the road tickets, UX prod features, et cetera, but it never, it simply died because it was living out in a kind of in its own little bubble in Jira and was not really used. So I think it's important that we, if this is to survive, it needs to be really have a purpose where it is a used tool.
What, I mean, this is ChatGPT, so take it with a grain of salt. Who knows if it's right? But it says that Jira automation can automatically create issues of one type when another is created or transitioned, copy fields from the source issue, and link the issues with a defined relationship. So if that's true, we could
It is.
create an issue type dip that is automatically created whenever a UX prod is create it, copy the fields over from the UX prod and establish a link between the two so that we could then, deal with these dip issues at a different dashboard, different context, maybe have additional data and processes for it, but they become linked to a UX prod and then also are able to derive data from the POs that have filled out that I don't
Yes.
know. Does that seem useful?
Yeah, I mean, I've actually this is 100% correct. I've actually it's in Jira Cloud. I've actually used this because we have our own Jira Cloud instance for CU Cornell University Library IT. And what I was doing is running a shadow Jira. So I had an internal ticketing system where I was keeping track of issues for our support group. And then I had a public-facing Jira, and there was information in this in the private Jira that I did not want over here. So I had a public description field, and when I updated that ticket or created a new ticket in the private system, it would create a mirror ticket over in the public system with that description from that one description field. So I could put in there like in our internal Jira, I could put in something along the lines of Anna is having issues with this fun code. It's not the balance needs to be this and blah, 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 blah. And then the public description is issue with fun balance. So it was very generic. So anyone looking at it didn't know any of the details of what was sent to me from our internal system, but they could still see what the ticket status was. So yeah, I use that all the time. And it's like that. Like you create a ticket and it pushes it
But we
over.
have about 7,000 UX prods, a little less, but we are getting
Yes.
close to 7,000.
Yeah,
And we
but we've
don't
been
want to
creating
duplicate
them.
that automatically. We probably produce a new UX prod, I don't know, every 5 minutes or something in a day. So
Right. Yeah,
we're
I don't
really.
know, but really, like, how many do get created in a day?
Yeah, I mean, what Charlotte's saying is true. Probably about, I mean, I just created three yesterday. So, I mean,
Well, that's problematic.
yes. But
I wonder if we would want to, I have no idea if you could do this, but if we would want to just include a checkbox when you're creating a UX prod that just says derive dip or something like that, so that
you
you can
don't.
decide whether or not you want a dip being to be created based on it.
Yeah, you could do that. I mean, the other one too is you don't have to have as an automatic automation, and you can have as an automatic automation. So, for instance, the example that I gave with our internal system, there was tickets that I did not want in the external system. So the initial step was once I created it, there was an automation that I had to manually kick off that said make public, and that created the public copy. And then on update, it actually, there was a field in there that was external ticket ID. It looked for that field, and if that field was populated with a value, it would then update the external ticket anytime I
Oh.
update the internal ticket.
Oh, well, because this says this said that is one of the shortfalls is keeping them keeping the derived fields linked. But it sounds like you found a way around that.
Yeah, you can link the two tickets together. That's fairly simple. The problem is that when you update the main ticket, there's nothing in the main ticket that really says that this is a copy of or this is a child ticket. So I
Sure.
actually created a text field that was external ticket or something of that nature that held the ticket name number in there, which allowed me to build the link to that ticket to do the updates. I probably still have all the automations in our old system. We just don't use it anymore.
Maybe it's because so I think it will be better to have to look at the same UX prod and not have a cloned old copy the PC is looking at, and then the POs are maintaining the real UX prod, and that will with the risk that when the PC or the what do you have suggested a controller of the dips is to look at, then he or her always need to go and look at the original UX prod. So again, I
So,
am worried to create a shadow system where we are in risk of, that the data grows in two different directions, and we always need to go back and have we updated this? Have we updated that? Da, ba, ba. time
let me
consuming.
a ask Charlotte, because you're right. I mean, I hate situations where you need data to be synchronized in two different representations. But one of the shortcomings to just saying, well, UX prod is a dip, is that there might be data that is very relevant to the dip process that wouldn't necessarily be appropriate to stick on the UX prod. And if we limit ourselves to representing a dip as a UX prod, then we limit ourselves only to those fields that are appropriate for UX prod. So what if the dip was an independent item and all it maintained was a link to the UX prod? You know, that so we don't try to copy fields over from the UX prod, but we just say, all right, here's a dip and it's connected to this UX prod, and we could have whatever fields we want on the dip, you know, to pull in. But if we want to go and see what the UX prod has to say, we just follow that link over to see the data in the original place. Is that better or?
We can test it and we can talk with the POs as well. I'd say I think it will be a good idea before we go very far with this that we have the POs on board and get their how is all of this fitting together also in their workday?
Martin?
Yeah, so I do not have practical experience with the folded Jira, so maybe I'm missing something, but I'm wondering, you said that there may be information that you want to have in a sep in this separate dip item, but not in the UX prod item, and I wondered what kind of information this could be, because I'm thinking, I mean, you basically couldn't put any kind of information into the UX prod, maybe, and I mean, if you include some information that is mainly important maybe for the PC or that is not important for POs, and so they can just go over it, and you can just tell them that this is information we need to have with the UX prod and don't bother about it. So that would be my thinking, but as I said, I don't have practical experience, so
I
maybe
think the
I'm
main
overlooking
one,
something.
I think the main one would be is that you would have in a dip that you won't have any UX prod. Is a lot right now the UX prods are very focused around development, where we may want to because. I wouldn't have it. I wouldn't have, let me rewind. I would not have the dip as a separate ticket type. I would have it as a separate space within Jira. So it would be its own workspace. So like UX prod, it's its own workspace or its own project. I would have dip as its own project. So it'd be dip one, dip two, dip whatever. And that will allow you to customize the forms for the dip entries. So we could say like, this needs to have at least five approvals from certain people on here. We could add specific fields on there for inner workings for PC, where those things, if you put them on a UX prod, it's just going to clutter it up and make it more difficult for the devs and for the POs on the UX prod. So I think that's where the difference would be is like the UX prod, I don't think we really want to add any more fields or information on there that isn't relevant to the development and keep that separate into the dip ticket that's more PC centric.
Yeah, so some of
Yes.
the fields are like, I mean, I'm guessing because we haven't written the minimally viable dip yet, so I don't know exactly what we're going to be requiring of a dip, but some possibilities are like we mentioned that there is a liaison, like a dip representative that is supposed to like be an individual that represents this, shepherds it through the process. So you would want to record that person on a dip. The state of approval from the various councils would want to approve that. At some point down the road, you want to record this, the stakeholders, like the people who are, interested in funding the dip or participating with it. You want to record who those people are on there. So
The funding was met.
If,
Well,
for
and then also
example,
just status, dip status. Like, where is it? What phase is it in? Where is it in the dip process?
but for example, the information about approval or endorsement from the councils, I think this would be information that is also relevant for the POs because they are the ones who will likely present the feature.
Yeah, I think I'm on the fence. I could
I'm
see it either way. Like I could see it being useful to just just basically have the dip process be just a way of interfacing with UX prod. I like that seems to step alongside what's already happening. And it makes me feel like that would give it more of a chance of success. But
I
I also
think.
don't like, I get apprehensive about the idea of like, well, we want to make a bunch of changes. I kind of feel like we want to make changes to somebody else's stuff, like, and that makes me nervous.
Yeah, I think the other thing is, though, too, is I'd have to dig into the settings because I have not played in Jira settings yet at much. Or maybe we just bring in Peter and talk to him as well. I think the link types that are in Jira are on a project by project basis. So blocked by has to be done before, that sort of thing. So we might even be able to come up with our own link types. So if we have, so for like instance, I was saying about like one of the nice things I could see with the dips is that we're tracking larger projects. Instead of creating an epic or something of that nature, we can create a single dip that says this is we're adding interlibrary loan to Folio. It's going to be the six UX prods, and all six of
The
those UX prods are under that dip. And they're just top levels. And it's just, and the link type is UX prods to be finished or work to be completed. And that will show you how the work is progressing for that individual dip. And then we could add other ones if we wanted to. I could also see it being a way of connecting the tech review as well. Like, as you said, later on down the road, funding. If it goes to an external group, who it gets sent to, who's doing the coding on it. I mean, it could also be a place to link documentation to as well.
I'm really glad, Thomas, that you mentioned that, because the idea, like, the relationship, the scope of a dip to a UX prod, can go either way. Like, I asked, is there a one-to-one relationship between a UX prod and a dip? And I think the answer probably is no, because not every UX prod probably needs to be associated with a dip. I think that that's the case. But then
And
also,
also,
one dip might be related to multiple UX prods. So,
and we are doing development in phases. So a dip would probably be, agreeing on funding the full functionality. But in order to be to plan according to the feature freeze date and all of this defined in the timeline, then we are slicing it into several phases.
Yes. And that could also be another aspect that's in the dip that's not in the UX prods, because right now UX prods are tied to a single release, where the dips could have two releases. Like, initial product release is this, completion release is this one. So you can see how far apart when it starts and when it ends is going to be. They could be the same value, but one could be, let's say, Umbrella Leaf, and the other one is Zinnia or whatever Z is. That's how big this project is going to take, how long the project is going to take. But I kind of like, once I said, I kind of like the idea of also using the dips for expanding, and that's where the usefulness might come in, is also expanding it that it could be something that could be used by the documentation group, something by the release management group and everyone else, as kind of a central working doc outside of the UX prods. So documentation, you do a query in the dips. These are all the dips that are being released. Okay, we know we need to update the documentation on this stuff. And then they could create their own tickets off that dip, and it's linked on there as a working document. It might be too much, but
Well,
it also.
It's intriguing for sure. There's no doubt that it's beyond the minimum, it goes beyond the minimally viable aspect of it, but yeah, I mean, it's interesting for sure.
I think we should maybe wait with that idea, because
Oh, yeah.
otherwise we have just introduced that we are to add this label into the tickets for each of the flower releases and for documentation needed. So we are thinking about that, and then it can be something we can enhance with later, but maybe we have all the funding pieces and the stakeholder pieces and all of that to get aligned first.
100%. Yeah.
So,
Agree. 100%. I'm just saying, like, later on, it could actually be the community side management of these things.
what I'm feeling like after this discussion, I think we've made some good headway. I think, thank you so much, Charlotte, for bringing this UX prod idea forward, because I more so than at the beginning of the meeting, I have a real vision now for the practical implementation of this idea. I guess in the back of my mind, I was always thinking, well, Jira is probably where we want to do this, but like, it's exciting to kind of start talking about the nuts and bolts of how that might actually work. And I what I'm going to propose is that I before next time, before like I'm going to shoot for before Friday this week, I'm going to try to draft a rough draft of the minimally viable DIP based on our previous conversations and our comparisons of the two documents and this conversation that we've just had about the nature of our inclusion with Jira. And that'll give us something to talk about next time. Ideally, if you guys have a couple days next week, Monday and Tuesday, to kind of look it over, and then we can show up on Wednesday and y'all can tell me how I got it all wrong and need to do it again. Does
But I
that work?
sounds really good, and I think you mentioned a good list of what is the different headings we need to include in the DIP, and it can be it's it filling in that information is not something you do when you write up the DIP the first time. Because you need to have all these stakeholders and who will
Yeah.
contribute, and it's a process to get all these ducks in the row
Yeah.
aligned.
And
So,
well, and the process as outlined, acknowledges that it's like in phase one, this is the information you need. But by phase two, you need to have expanded it to, to this information. And so, yeah, I'm excited. Martin.
Yeah. Something. My problem at the moment is that if we are not going to, if we say we don't want to reuse or hijack the UX prods, we say, I mean, the DIP information will be recorded and or collected and so on. But who is doing that then? I mean, for me, the advantage of just reusing UX prod was that there's already someone who is going to input all the information in the UX prod, and we can just, yeah, some kind of reuse this information, maybe add some more that is needed. But if we have a completely separate way of recording the DIP, who is doing all the work? I mean, there may be some pieces that can be done automatically, like creating a DIP out of a UX prod. But if you have multiple UX prod in one DIP, or if other information that has to be recorded, who is doing that? We always say that we don't want to put the effort on the POs, but who else is going to do that? Is it the PC? Is do we need just as we discussed in the last meetings, maybe do we have to have some kind of roles like officers or who are responsible for filling out all the DIP stuff? Is it the sick liaisons that will be responsible? Is it someone else? Maybe someone from the six? I don't know. So I think this is crucial because if we make up a new information space, then we need to tell or to state who is going to be responsible for that, for maintaining all the information.
So this is admittedly kind of hand wavy and like just kicking actually answering your question like down the road a little bit. But the DIP process identifies this idea of a specific individual being identified as a coordinator for that DIP. And it does not specify whether or not that person is a PO or a member of a SIG or a member of the product council at all. I think that that's something that we can talk about, but I think it's possible that this is just somebody who is willing to advocate for the development effort, regardless of where they come from, whether they're a PC member or a SIG member or the PO, or just somebody who's willing to say, look, I want to represent this development effort in this process. Now it might need more definition than that, but I guess when I was initially writing this, I thought about that question that you're asking, Martin, and I didn't know the answer, so I was just like, well, we need somebody to be the person.
Yeah, you're kind of talking with this one. This is a one by one basis. I think what Martin is saying is like an overall holistic view. But I mean that I think that because this is coming from PC, I think it would fall under the responsibility of PC. I would actually suggest a specific working group that's a long-standing working group under PC that their entire job is to kind of keep an eye on new DIPs coming in. Maybe close out old ones. They take care of the maintenance. I agree. Like there has to be a proposed coordinator that's the shepherd of individual ones to try to get it done. But I also think that some of the work can be pushed back on the SIGs because right now, some of the SIGs are picking up, going through all the UX prods, ranking them whether or not they need to be open or closed, and then also if they're going to start refining them. I could see some of the DIP work going back to them as well, saying, these need more information, these need more work. Here, you're the experts on it. Do that. But I think for like long-term care, I think it's going to have to be a standing group that does a lot of this stuff.
It is an essential question, because if we don't define who is responsible, then no one will be responsible and it won't happen.
Exactly.
Well, folks, I appreciate y'all engaging with this topic and as always. And hopefully I'll get a good draft together. I'm gonna shoot for by this Friday to have something out to share with all y'all.
I need to take a puppy to a vet. She had her
Hope
shots and
everybody's
blood tests
okay.
on. Yeah, no, she's fine. She had her shots and a blood test on Saturday, and it came back positive that she was exposed to Lyme disease. So I had to take her to her regular vet to have more blood tests done and see if she has to go on antibiotics. But it's definitely not slowing her down. She's bouncing around like a little jumping bean. So,
Well, best of luck with that, and
thanks.
take it easy,
Take care. Yeah.
folks.
Bye-bye. Stay
Bye.
warm. Bye.